It's my pleasure now to introduce the chair of this program today, Dr. Andre Novak, with whom I've had the pleasure to work for several years at these APA meetings, where both of us have tried to bring together programs like this, which cover a variety of intergenerational traumata and the effects on succeeding generations. Here we have animals, now we have back to humans with Dr. Novak. Dr. Novak is Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at the University of California at Irvine. He's Medical Director of the Partial Hospitalization Program at UCI Medical Center. He also is himself a Holocaust survivor.
Child of a survivor.
And, well, you see, he's been affected, and therefore I am affected. And so I feel it as I introduce him. The intergenerational effect. Dr. Novak has written and published in the area of mood and anxiety disorders, traumatic stress, and mechanisms of trauma and vulnerability in psychiatry. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Novak.
Can we dim the lights, please? It is now my task to talk about acquired vulnerability and the relationship between intergenerational transmission of trauma or intergenerational aspects of trauma and such mechanisms of vulnerability. Now, as you see, I have entitled this presentation Assessing Intergenerational Traumatic Stress because one of the next tasks for clinicians will be to develop objective measurements for the measurement of the amount of stress that is being transmitted, as well as the mechanisms in humans. As you heard Dr. Sumi talk about such mechanisms in animals, but it will be now important to further study the biological mechanisms in humans as well. May I have the next slide? As you can see, there is a lot of controversy about the subject of generalized anxiety at this point, and this is very much in connection to our presentation. As you can see, generalized anxiety has to do something with traumatic stress. This is from Dr. Robinson in Canada. And it has been proposed that subtle symptoms of anxiety seen in children early in life may in fact be the first tip of an iceberg, the first symptoms of vulnerability. And one of the studies by Leibovitz and his group has in fact proposed to delete generalized anxiety from the diagnostic classifications and view it as a common pathway towards psychopathology, an early sign, an early vulnerability that individuals develop probably sometimes within the first 5 years of life. Now, when we talk about transmission, in the literature there are several types of transmission. This is a model that comes from Kenneth Kendler, who has referred to transmission of traits. He has not studied specifically the transmission of trauma from one generation to another. I renamed this vertical transmission because it focuses mainly on the processes that exist between G1, G2, and G3, and again emphasizes the transmission of traits rather than acquired traits. Now, the traits here may be transmitted in a direct or indirect manner. In other words, behavior, a specific behavior in G1 may induce a different type of behavior in G2, and that would be indirect transmission, while G1, while in the direct type of transmission, a specific behavior in G1 will induce the same type of behavior in G2. Now, when we study intergenerational transmission of trauma, it is important to refer to this work because some of the mechanisms in humans are likely to be very similar. Now, I call this the lateral vertical transmission, which is more the model that we are studying in our traumatized populations. And as you can see, it's lateral because it's coming from the side. G1 is being specifically traumatized here by extrafamilial processes. In I had an interest in the children of Holocaust survivors, but as you heard today and as you heard Dr. Danieli, this field is being expanded now to other populations. And as you can see, trauma is occurring here, and then the transmission, the mechanisms of transmissions, which are most likely similar to what Dr. Sumi has presented, occur then between G1 and G2, and most likely between G2 and G3, and further on. Now, in terms of, again, a much more extensive presentation of previous studies that was given by Dr. Danieli, and I will refer here only to very few titles that have inspired work in the area of biological vulnerability. This is an older study by Solomon in Israel, where children of Holocaust survivors who developed combat-related PTSD took longer to recover. In fact, the findings are more complex, but I just wanted to refer briefly to that. Then Rosenheck studies that were mentioned by Dr. Danieli, and including the 1998 chapter in her book. Dr. Danieli mentioned already malignant PTSD. Again, we need to look at this also from a biological point of view. Next slide. Then there are other studies, Heyer et al., who studied Vietnam veterans with PTSD and tried to find correlations with what he referred to as preparation for the trauma, in quote-unquote preparation. In other words, a negative experience or repeated negative experiences in the upbringing of these Vietnam veterans made it more likely that they would come down with PTSD. Of course, here Dr. Danieli's initial study, but there are others too, just to mention the rupture that she has talked about. And here another study that is in Dr. Danieli's book by Kathleen Nader, who studied basically the symptomatology of PTSD, which was more likely to be present after a sniper attack on an LA school ground, which happened in the 1980s. And it was more likely to happen in children whose parents had a significant history of trauma. That is fascinating. And finally, our own contribution, I brought here the article, which is mentioned in Dr. Danieli's studies, but it is more likely, I mean, what we did is we looked at the outcome, at comorbidity in a treatment-seeking population of children of Holocaust survivors. In other words, there was an assumption here that individuals who developed have a natural occurrence of psychiatric disorder. If such individuals develop more than one psychiatric disorder and have even more comorbidity, that would be a sign of vulnerability. The assumption is comes from medicine and was now confirmed in psychiatry in one of the articles in the December issue of the Green Journal, that individuals who have more than one disorder, 2, 3, 4 diagnoses, are sicker, take longer to recover, and have much longer periods of disability. Now, this is just to mention, I have presented this before, 2 years ago. The study was completed only about a year ago, but basically, again, in our, this is our population, children of Holocaust survivors and matched controls. And as you can see, not only the comorbidity, in other words, patients were, all these patients were coming, were being evaluated for symptoms of anxiety and depression. As you know, anxiety and depression may be present without qualifying an individual for a double diagnosis. Some patients who have just meet criteria for major depression will have some anxiety. So what we did is we looked at the population that was coming into our clinic, and we found that, of course, the evaluator was blinded for the initial diagnosis. But in the end, we found that patients who were children of Holocaust survivors had a much higher comorbidity of anxiety and depression diagnosis. In other words, they were meeting criteria for DSM-4 diagnosis. What is the significance of that? Well, the significance is that, again, the Dr. Daniele's statement that this is a heterogeneous population. Well, if you have a population of children of survivors that are characterized by more comorbidity and more atypical depression compared to another similar population that has only one or two types of diagnosis, then we could conclude, based on this study, and this is preliminary, that in general, the population of children of Holocaust survivors have a more heterogeneous presentation in the area of psychopathology. So not only confirms that was Dr. Daniele, but Dr. Daniele told us that these populations are very heterogeneous, which we know, of course, now, but it confirms that when they get sick, when they develop a natural, when there is a natural occurrence of psychiatric disorders, these people are also more heterogeneous. They have more symptoms, they have more diagnoses, and very often have atypical diagnoses. And based on this, on Dr. Sumi's work, which you heard, beautiful, elegant work done on monkeys, we are proposing a mechanism of transmission, again, this is a proposal, of trauma, and this focuses more on the biological wiring that occurs. And basically, we also believe that in humans, as well as in in humans as well as in monkeys, there are three mechanisms that most likely are concomitant and that have to be at play in order to produce a biological vulnerability. Now, it has to do with transmission, it has to do with exposure. Again, we're going back to Dr. Daniele's work. She presented before the psychological transmission of the contents and how families cope with that and how there are four types of families and so on. Now, verbal and nonverbal transmission of information is the first mechanism. And this is based on a previous study of ours done in Los Angeles, where approximately 50% of children of survivors grew up with stories of the Holocaust, while another 50% did not have those stories. But at the outcome, when we looked at functional different elements, psychopathology, yes, no, and many other functional parameters, there was no major difference between them, whether they grew up with verbal and verbal or without the verbal transmission, which is the telling of story. And, you know, again, I'm going to refer to Dr. Daniele's bits and pieces, yes, of transmission. Very often, nonverbal transmission is much more important. It creates in families a sense of mystery that something terrible has happened without saying what happened. And when you interview many of these individuals, they will tell you that they grew up with this heaviness in their families, a nonverbal sort of meaning that life is very serious. Not only that life is very serious and so on, but that something very terrible happened in the past without saying what it is. Now, this is perhaps the most psychological of mechanisms, but it most likely has an impact on the dysregulation of stress hormones. The second mechanism, the transmission of acquired traits, is most likely to be present. I mentioned already, I described initially how traits from G1 to G2 and G3 may be transmitted directly or indirectly. This is not at all specific for children of survivors or trauma, but is most likely characteristic for all traits, but it is likely to be at play in this case as well. And finally, the most biological of mechanisms, the intrafamilial microtraumatization, sort of a dysregulation, this is a biological dysregulation, which we believe, and there's early evidence that unpredictable familiar environments create or constitute a dysregulating factor. And here is sort of a sequence of events that takes place between hormones and an unpredictable familiar environment, which leads to arousal and kindling and cortisol changes and peaks. And again, somebody asked here about Dr. Yehuda's work. This is consistent with her findings. I just wanted to reiterate that, according to her findings, of course, the more chronic the stress, the lower the cortisol at baseline, and then a high peak occurs during re-traumatization. Okay, let's move to the next slide. Now, just to support what I mentioned before, these are earlier studies. Mason and Hellhammer, this is a study from Germany, and Mason, 1968, much earlier, that showed that ambiguity, novelty, unpredictability, and uncontrollability are the most potent stimulators of the HPA axis. And Hellhammer, again, in 1991, showed that the synchrony of cortisol occurs in children and their mothers, as well as in adults between life partners. Perhaps somebody wrote his projective identification, an early perhaps suggestion that certain psychological mechanisms which are at play between life partners, between people who live together, may have a biological basis. As you can see, transmission of traits or transmission of trauma, Hamlet's great-great-great-great-grandson contemplates show business. Whether this is it nobler to be a flavor of the month or not to be a flavor at all? I found it, you know, it sort of suggests a little bit. It's not exactly what happened to Hamlet and the way Hamlet expressed it, but it's sort of suggestive of it. And this is how I'd like you to think about these kind of mechanisms of transmission. It's not a copy, an exact copy of the processes in the parents, but there are new processes that are suggestive of what is going on with the previous generation. Let's move. Okay, now in terms of assessment of vulnerability, this is, as you know, first of all, that vulnerability and especially acquired vulnerability has been largely ignored for many years. After 1980 and the DSM-3, there was a lot of emphasis on genetic vulnerability. The assumption was, like with Kraepelin, going back to the description of very clear psychiatric syndromes, that these are transmitted disorders, they're exclusive biological, and so on. Now, further studies have shown that stress per se and traumatic stress tends to have a long-lasting impact not only on the reactivity of an individual, which is measured by psychological parameters, but also, as Robert Post has recently shown, the genetic component of the cell changes in after exposure to trauma. So there is a much deeper adaptation of the genomes of individuals after chronic trauma. Now, the way I propose that we assess vulnerability would include, of course, taking a history, measuring certain biological markers, which I will be referring to, then a subject that we are interested in now, we have proposed an intergenerational traumatic screening scale, and finally, talking about comorbidity. Now, for some biological markers of vulnerability, as you can see, can we focus that? Okay. This is an area that is in its infancy, but certain biological markers have been around for years. And as you know, the DST, which was developed initially for the diagnosis of depressive disorders and to basically evidence the biological component of depressive disorders, has been used also in the field of post-traumatic stress and trauma. Now, the interesting thing is that certain individuals after trauma do not develop PTSD. As you know, that PTSD is a relatively rare occurrence after trauma. What's the prevalence of PTSD? Well, does anyone? Not you. What did you say?
Well, it varies on the population.
Right. But in traumatized populations, you can anywhere from 15 to 20%. And in the general population, you can have between earlier studies 3.5% to 7.5%, which is quite a bit. I mean, it's more than depressive disorders, which is 6%. Well, but the importance is that many individuals who do not develop post-traumatic stress but develop major depression have changes in, after trauma, of course, have changes in DST and become some of them super suppressors while others become non-suppressors. And we don't exactly understand yet the significance of this mechanism, but it is important to know that perhaps this is the first sign or first indication that affective mood disorders and anxiety disorders will have to be classified in the future into traumatic and non-traumatic. And we leave that open. The heat shock protein 72 was evidenced in rats who were exposed to trauma. The vagal tone measurements, which measures the respiratory sinus arrhythmia, was proposed as a method of studying vulnerability by Stephen Porges. And finally, I already referred to generalized anxiety disorder and the question whether this is a disease or a vulnerability. Let's move on. Now, I'm not going to get into all these details because we don't have much time, but if you are interested, I will be happy to answer questions. What is important, Porges has done very elegant work on the vagal nerve, and the vagal nerve, as you know, is involved in innervating the parasympathetic nerve of all the organs, and he proposes that, first of all, it is known, we know from anatomy, if you remember, that the vagal nerve has at least a double origin, the nucleus ambiguus in the brainstem and the dorsal motor nucleus. And what was more recently shown in 1990, I believe, that the amygdala has very strong projections to both of these nucleus. And as you know, the amygdala is involved in regulating and is very much involved in the expression of reactivity to stress. And that the fibers of the vagal nerve that come from the nucleus ambiguus constitute a so-called neovagal nerve, which is myelinated and develops phylogenetically much later compared to the fibers that come from the dorsal motor nucleus, which develop phylogenetically much earlier. This myelinated vagus comes from the primitive gill arches embryologically, but what is important is that most likely these fibers are involved in expressing bonding behaviors like vocalization, breathing, reading of facial expression and so on. This is very fascinating. What is it? Okay, we still have one. Okay. This is a proposal. We will perhaps, if anyone is interested, this is the scale that we are working on at Irvine. Intergenerational trauma, this is stress, and the last S stands for intergenerational trauma. No, not, it's intergenerational assessment. This is intergenerational trauma stress scale. It's a screening test. It's a screening test. And I'm more than happy to talk more about it, but we developed a sort of a scoring of what happens when you have father, mother that are exposed to stress, then you are, and yourself, you, if ourselves, okay, if the individual, the subject has a low score and the mother and father have high scores on traumatic stress, this is a good subject for our studies because it's the, compared to somebody who has himself a lot of stresses in life. And what we did, we have a score that we subtract from the sum of these scores. Okay, here, this is just intergenerational transmission most likely leads to expansion of psychopathology. And this is a challenging statement that I'm making now. It will, again, we will have most likely, will be responsible for proving this over the next few years. But it will be important because this will show directly that trauma in society expands psychopathology, especially in the area of anxiety and depressive disorders. Let's go to the next. And again, we can, Dr. Sumi spoke about that. Next one. And we just propose that the intergenerational transmission of trauma in humans, based on Dr. Sumi's work, may be a phylogenetically based mechanism of adaptation, a biologically based mechanism by which offspring are prepared and pre-informed about dangers, and that the individuals, the populations that we are studying, have experienced sort of an overshoot of this normal biological mechanism. Next. And here, just to end, I feel compelled to show you some statistics of this century, which is coming to an end, and which certainly has an impact about behavior and psychopathology in the next century. Thank you.